Hello and welcome to Behind the Book, the monthly guest episode of the Creating Happy Writers podcast. Here is where I sit down with brilliant female authors and industry experts who are shaking up the publishing world. In each episode, we explore the powerful ideas and expertise within their books and then uncover the personal story of how they brought that knowledge to the page. Whether you're drafting your business book right now, polishing your manuscript, or dreaming of seeing your expertise in print, these conversations will fuel your creative fire and give you the tools to write with confidence. So join me today for the kind of honest talk about the writing life you won't find anywhere else. Have you ever felt like your life is too cluttered to make space for your writing? Or do you wonder if there's a simpler way to live that would free up your creative energy? Well, today's guest and I talk about all of this and so much more. Elizabeth Miquetta is a storyteller and the author of 13 books across a whole range of genres, including the fantastic Edit Your Life, published in 2023. Her work includes numerous published poems too, and she delivered the TEDx Boise Talk, Edit Your Life Like a Poem. Elizabeth holds degrees in literature from Harvard, her BA, Georgetown, her MA, and the University of Texas at Austin, PhD. Her doctoral dissertation explored the fascinating intersections between memoir and myth, a concept that continues to inform her teaching, writing, and her entire approach to viewing the world. She currently teaches for the Harvard Extension School Writing Program and Oxford University's Diploma in Creative Writing. She also mentors a select group of writers each year through the Book Year Writers Circle. During our brilliant conversation, and it is brilliant, Elizabeth and I explore the concept of editing, not just our writing, but our lives, to create space for creativity and purpose. We chat about a whole host of things, including the natural back and forth between creative seasons and the practical business side of a writer's life, how simplifying our lives from our living spaces to our commitments can free us to focus on what truly matters, including how she and her family made a radical decision to downsize from their large American house to a tiny 375 square foot backyard structure that was originally built as her writing shed. We also chat about finding your personal creative rhythm and the courage to follow it, even when it goes against what everyone else is doing. The power of small, consistent writing practices, even just 30 minutes a day, versus the myth of needing endless hours. And how dealing with other people's reactions when making big life changes can actually help us get clearer on what we really want. I genuinely cannot wait for you to listen to this honest and insightful conversation about creating a life that supports your writing and your creativity. It is quite honestly one of my very favorite conversations. I hope you enjoy it. Well, thank you, Elizabeth, for joining us today for the episode. I have been looking forward to talking to you very much because the theme of your book, Edit Your Life, is something that I feel a theme that I've been really playing with these last 12 months. I've been really working hard on many aspects of my business and my writing has suffered. And I have not written anything book-wise for about 6 to 7 months, which for me is the longest I haven't written in my whole life. So it's been a really difficult time in terms of creatively. And I really wanted to talk to you about the book, about the concepts of the book, and just what it means to edit our lives. But before I get to that, I just would love to know your publishing journey. Where did you start? How did you get to write so many books? And what's the journey been for you?
Yes. And thank you so much for hosting me. This is such a delight to be here and to speak with you. And I love what you do on your podcast. And I love that we get to have this hour and talk about these things. So yes, so we must talk about the editing. And I love the way that you describe that in terms of a tilt, that it seems like there are times when, as a writer and someone who's living a creative life, which is such a long game, there are times when when we tilt completely into just being in in project, and then one project finishes and we're in another project and we're sort of surfing projects. And I think of this as a mother of having kids who wake into projects, who will wake up and just sort of drift into making cardboard apartments for their stuffed animals or making board games, or they just kind of drift into wanting to make art because it's fun. And I think of that as, you know, we have seasons of that. And then we have seasons where I think of we're maybe working more on, as you say, the business. And I think of those as sometimes the seasons of the kind of infrastructure that supports the creative life, if we can call it that. I sometimes think of those as seasons of just building floor, just figuring out, you know, what is the schedule going to be? How does teaching fit with writing? What are we doing in this house? You know, how are we going? How do we live in a way that supports all of our projects? And I love the way that you described that, because that seems like the very natural tilt that I imagine many listeners can identify with, that, you know, sometimes there are balanced days and sometimes there are balanced years or seasons, but each bit in its own is completely imbalanced.
Do you have writing seasons? Do you find that you have seasons where you are doing, because I know you teach writing, is it something that you intentionally, and I know we're shifting into the theme of the book, but is it something you intentionally have done where you decide that actually in these months of the year, I focus more on the teaching, and in these months, I feel more like I'm aligned to writing? Do you do that?
Well, it's funny. I'm starting to do that, but I never have before. And so, yes, and that ties beautifully into the question of the how. In the past, I've always liked to have a book that I'm working on. I've thought of it, and it doesn't ever work out to be a perfect science, but the ideal has always been to have a book each year and to have a season when I'm creating and composting and just flinging spaghetti at the wall and just trying to get it to exist. And then a season, right? The season of just like make a creative mess. Don't worry about if it's any good. And then that, of course, gives way to a season of making it good and trying to figure out how to craft it so that it works for the reader. And then a season of sending it out to find its home. And of course, that never works perfectly because it takes a long time for a book to find its home. And it sometimes takes a long time, much longer, I find, to revise a book than to write a book. And then sometimes just when you're halfway through a book that you think is going swimmingly, another book idea crops up and you think, oh no, I have to make a choice. And so you either write on both clumsily for a few years or you shove one off the desk and pick up the other one. But there's always something that comes out of the water and makes it messy, which seems part of the beauty of it and also part of the frustration when we as writers are trying to live orderly lives where the writing fits into the kind of systems of our days. So for the books that I've published so far, which have been varied and in many different genres, they've all been written in the years since becoming a mother. So I had my daughter when I was 30, and that was when I decided to put writing front and center rather than doing the dance of, oh, I write when I'm inspired, oh, I write when I'm at a cafe and bored, oh, I write when I'm lonely. And so that was when I started thinking of it in more of a work way. I had quit my teaching job to write, which is always tricky business because, you know, teaching has a lovely structure and teaching has a lovely income. And also I find that the myth of the, you can write all day can sometimes be a problem because if you have all day and you think, but why am I not inspired 8 hours a day? So I find that there are a lot of benefits in maybe starting a project or starting a writing journey when the life is already quite full. I found that it helped a lot with discipline, not even feeling like discipline, but just when there was a quiet moment when the baby was sleeping, instead of wondering, do I sweep? Do I read? Do I call my mom? It was, I write. So I sort of knew always where to go, which was, so in a way, there were some parts of it that were kind of easier when, you know, when the children were little, but throughout, you know, each book taught me something about how to write a book and something about what not to do. And so with each one, I felt that I sort of deepened my feet a little bit more into the soil of being able to say, I'm a writer. I write books. I write most days, except for taking August off. You know, I close my door and need to not be interrupted for this hour or 4 hours or fill in the blank. So I think that each book kind of deepened my trust in it. And I think that probably happens to a lot of writers that like anything, like exercise, like a marriage, that the sort of more time we spend in connection with it, the more deeply we trust it. And the less time we sort of faff about with thinking like, but maybe it's not to be, you know, maybe it's not this or that. So long way back to the original question of the seasons, what I have identified, and this is a strange surprise, and I'm not sure what to do with it yet, is that I often, and maybe this is because teaching ramps up for teachers in the fall, I often work very hard to try to get my books to coexist with my classes and with getting my kids back to school. And it never feels like I'm in sort of perfect writing flow in the fall, but I can usually like wrangle myself to the desk. But it feels generally like the writing is kind of disappointing and forced. Whereas then in the spring, you know, when the kids are in a routine and I'm sort of back into the mode of, you know, I've taught my classes a few times and the days are getting longer. Somehow, sometime around late February, I just get a surge of energy and I want to write all the time and I want to write every day and I want to go to the cafe and have my coffee and muffin and write. And I often spend the whole month of March undoing the mess that I've made of my book in the fall. So my husband has observed, what if we were to just start in April? Because I think that sort of would, you know, maybe be a little more efficient. So I do think that there are certain seasons, sort of the February to July for me, where I just feel like I can trust where I'm going and I don't overthink my writing decisions. And I feel that there's enough time to not care if I'm getting it right the first time because I can go back and get it right later. So, you know, all of this is sort of a long way of saying flow, you know, flow, happy, the happy being in a project, which I think is probably the happiest place for most creative people to be, is just, you know, in a project that we're excited to wake up to. And so this year, I'm going to shift that a little bit because I've clustered my classes around sort of November. Most of my classes are on November to February. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with those kind of restraints in the writing. So stay tuned. But in the past, it's most of the year, but definitely more fluid in the spring.
Yeah, I feel this year's the first time I've allowed myself not to be persuaded by, I guess, what conventional rules there might be around times of year, right? So I have always thought that I should, because I'm very good at shoulding, I should do big goals and new projects in January because it's new year, new projects, all that sort of thing. And, you know, this is going to be the year that I do. But, and this was the first year where I actively rejected January as a starting point because I just felt, for me, naturally, like you, I'm much more of a March girl. I like March. I like April. I feel so much more inclined to do the bigger things. And it was such a revelation. And I'm thrilled that I trust in my gut to go with it, because otherwise I'd be forcing myself to be creative or take on a project when actually naturally for me, January just isn't the time. I'm a summer born baby. I don't know whether that has anything to do with it, but I like the spring, summer months for that kind of thing. And then autumn is more for me a time where I sort of hunker down a little bit and I kind of look inward and a bit more reflective. And I just try to take the creative things a bit easier. And like I say, have thoughts about things and play around with ideas. But the actual main drive, I think, for me seems to be, like you, spring. There just seems to be an energy, doesn't there, in spring?
There is an energy. I'm thinking, I'm probably going to botch the quote, but the Dylan Thomas quote, the force that through the green fuse drives the flower. The quote, force that through the, and it feels there's so much of that green force in March. And that does make sense that writers would feel that too. And I love that you've been able to buck the January should. This is inspiring. I've never bucked the January should, and I've driven myself crazy in various Januaries thinking, but this year I will be different. And I think maybe this year I will follow your lead and see what happens when that goes away.
I think it's trying not to be pulled in by society or social media's ask, you know, what they think we should be doing, and not to follow the trend of, oh, it's January, you've got to set New Year's goals. And so, like I say, for everyone, I think it's different. And I really feel creatively, as well as with a business hat on or whatever, we should just be doing what feels right for us. And I think your book seems to be a way of really looking inward and thinking to ourselves, right, I've maybe done things I felt like I should do or I have to do. And when is the time when, and I feel like for women over 40, I think as I've gone into my 40s, I don't know whether you found this, there's just this transition into feeling more like, no, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not doing the, well, everyone says I should do this, so I'm going to do this. And it feels very freeing. It feels very liberating. And I wonder with that in mind, whether you would be happy to just talk a bit about your Edit Your Life book and what led you to write it and what you feel has had the most impact, I guess, on you from writing it and the experience of writing it.
Yes, I love this. So the Edit Your Life, oh, is about being 40. Yes. Absolutely. I feel that I've been waiting my entire life to turn 40.
Yes. Yes.
It feels great. Yeah. I've heard other women say that, and they are right. It is, this just the best. So many things, well, get edited out. So many, mm-hmm. since so many kind of false shells of self get edited out. And I think you said it perfectly when you said that there are, that a lot of it is just trying to be a critical thinker about what society does or suggests that we do. And that was very much what Edit Your Life came from. That when the catalyst for the book was that my family, when my children were 3 and 6, moved from a big American house like you hope you will have once you have kids and, mm-hmm. you know, get a second car and have stuff and have jobs. The sort of the house that most families my age were evolving into. We moved out of ours in order to live in my office, actually, in a tiny backyard mother-in-law that we'd built to be my, what we called writing shed, but that also had a sleeping loft, a little kitchen. It was just sort of a one-room cabin that was intended to house visiting grandparents and my writing workshops. We moved there because we felt that when we stopped to think about what we had built this whole life in order to focus on, which was doing meaningful work and having a lot of meaningful time with our kids when they were, you know, at each stage of their lives, it felt that the lion's share of our energy on any given day was going to the scaffoldings built to uphold those, the, you know, figuring out how to manage the house, the schedule, the money, the roof, the babysitter, the, you know, so many things that just felt like these structures that were taking us away from having our feet on the floor of here are the things we wish to look back on our lives and remember. Mm-hmm. And for writers, that's almost always, you know, a creative practice that, yeah. you know, we need very little, turns out, you know, a little exercise, you know, a few good friends, you know, maybe we're lucky enough to have them in our immediate family, to be married to one, a project that we can do at home, you know, something that we get to make, whether, you know, vegan soups or books or music, maybe rest and clean air. I mean, it's very little at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And it felt like in the era of life, before we made this big edit to live in this tiny place, that we had sort of fallen into the trap that I think so many people get overwhelmed by falling into, of just feeling that the things that mattered were getting abandoned and forgotten and ignored for things that if we stopped and thought about it, didn't really matter that much at all. So it was a very practical decision, even though it was a decision that raised quite a bit of concern from the people who love us most. My mom, when she heard that we were moving into a 375 square foot house, said, you know, tell me the truth. Are you getting divorced? And my younger sister said, tell me the truth. Have you gone bankrupt? And one of our best friends in the neighborhood said, huh, have you ever heard the term moderation before? Like there's something in the middle between, you know, too big, too small. But it felt like a simple solution that in a single go solved a lot of problems. And so we thought we would try. And it was a wonderful, I mean, from day one, and I keep using the metaphor of our feet on the floor, it felt like that lovely feeling of just feeling like you're sitting in the grass, like you're just, you know, standing on the solid wooden floor and saying, okay, here we are. There was just a simplicity of it from the first day that felt like so many weights that we, again, had gotten accustomed to bearing, but, you know, weights on, you know, on marriage. Like there are times, I think, when life feels complicated and marriage feels like this, you know, past the baby business transaction, you know, we felt like all of a sudden we could sort of look at each other, my husband and I, and say, you know, hello, human, you know, how are you? Let's go have lunch together. Because it freed up so much time that was spent, you know, sort of taking care of house and, you know, taking care of house, I think sort of encapsulated, you know, a lot of the activities that didn't feel meaningful to us. So it really took us to, it was a big edit. And since that move, I've really rarely had a day when I didn't feel that the core needs of, you know, creativity, people, you know, the sort of basic needs weren't met, you know, not in excess, but enough. And I think that is what I had been craving. And I think that's what, when we all get overwhelmed, we're all craving is a connection to these basic energy sources that we know will ground us. Mm-hmm. And I think that now the topic of, you know, minimalism and stoicism, and there are, I think, a lot of people who in our complicated age of, you know, consumerism and post-pandemic, I mean, I think there are a lot of things that are causing people to think, what exactly do I need? And could I feel freer if I needed less? And I think that really is the trick. And it's such an old trick. It feels cliched talking about such a trick. But as, you know, my husband often says to my children about our children about things like this, you know, like all great truths, it is simple, but not easy.
I wonder, do you think there was a moment when you think back on that time when you decided, do you know what, we're going to do this? Because I often think, so my husband and I, we live with my parents. So we live in an extended family. So my parents live in the house. We're there as well. My children are there. So we grow, you know, and I grew up in an extended family with my grandparents. So I'm used to growing up in an environment where the grandparents are a very important and loved part of the growing up experience. But my children are growing up. They are approaching adulthood, and I'm sure it will be here before I can even imagine it. And my husband and I often talk about, well, what's next for us? The next chapter, pardon the book pun, but I can't help it. The next chapter of our lives. And I had my children when I was 26 and 27. So they're only 18 months apart. So I feel like now when they move on, go to university or get jobs or whatever they want to do, I'll only be in my mid 40s. So I feel like there's a lot of life left to live. And we are constantly talking about, where will we go? What will we do? And I grew up in the house that I'm still in. So I've been here for 40 plus years as a child and now as an adult. And for me, it's an opportunity I see to try living somewhere else in a different community, getting to know different places and people. And I'm excited about it. But I often feel like we can have these conversations, but the doing it is the thing. So you can talk about it and the theorizing of it sounds brilliant. But when it's time to actually make the decision, I don't know. I wonder whether, was there a moment that actually made you think, yeah, we're doing it? Not just talk about it. Can you reflect back on that?
I love this. And I love so many things about what you said. One of them is the intergenerational house. That is the next edit I would love to make. And I've been telling my parents, I would love to find a way for us to do that, because that's the way people, you know, humans have lived for ages. Mm-hmm. And so many of, you know, so, I mean, if we're all lucky, we will all get to be children, adults, and old. And each of those phases benefits so much from interdependence with the others and takes so much pressure off of the kind of, you know, burden of responsibility of the middle and the, you know, needing wisdom and patience of the young and the, you know, the sort of loneliness of people as they reach the end of life. I mean, there's so many things that humans have solved for as long as there have been humans by living in that way. And I love that you do that. And I know that any way of living has its, you know, complications, and there's no perfect way, but that way has a lot to recommend it that really, I think, no one regrets having lived in that way. That's so neat that you do that. And yeah, I think that that's a really good point about how people talk about a lot, how it's easy to talk about things and be afraid to try it. I have a rock. It's not on my desk anymore, but it was, that says, inhale courage, exhale fear. And I think that it's, you know, a lot of these changes are terrifying because it feels like we'll make the wrong change. Mm-hmm. It feels like we'll screw something up that was working well enough and that we can't necessarily go back to if we quit the job, travel for the year. But at the end of the day, I think that a few things are helpful for us as we make big decisions. One of them is that as writers, we have the opportunity to sort of walk down the path of as many different lives as we want. So by the time we've, in a way, you know, I'm sure listeners have felt that, and I know I have, and I'm sure you have, that we've explored a lot more lives than we actually live. And that doesn't even consider, you know, those of us who keep journals or something journal-like, you know, morning pages, a place to sort of process all the things that I think through just the act of writing, I think we sort of have to and get to look ourselves in the face a little bit more and say, yes, a change does have to happen. Or actually, I have a new perspective on that. This is a better situation than I had been thinking. But we have those mirror moments all the time if we're really kind of following our creativity where it will take us. And so I think writers have sort of an advantage in that way, that we're probably not going to make a dumb move because we've kind of seen it imaginatively farther than we might have otherwise. And through our writing, we've kind of accessed, you know, what is necessary and what is maybe not. Also, pretty much everything is in some form reversible except for having kids. And one of my mentors reminds me of that whenever I get nervous about a choice, that pretty much everything can be, you know, apologized and backtracked from if necessary. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that often if we are, and there are exceptions to this, of course, but I think that if we're deeply longing for something and if it comes up more than as a whim when we're having a glass of wine, you know, but comes up every time we have a glass of wine or in many conversations with our spouses or in our morning pages a lot, you know, if something is coming, is knocking on the door, we need something from it. You know, there's something it offers us and it might not show the right form immediately. And when my husband and I were feeling like life is too big, we considered so many things that felt like simpler solutions and easier, less drastic edits. You know, should we try take on this job? Should we take off that job? Should we have someone live with us and help with childcare? Should we, you know, try all these things? But it was sort of a moment, it was a day of desperation when we both were ready to act on it. Usually in my, I guess every marriage has sort of a different pace in terms of readiness for things. And I've come to feel accepting of the different sort of pace that my husband and I have, although there have definitely been eras in our 16 years of marriage when it's driven us both crazy. But we always arrive at the same place. You know, we're philosophically very aligned. We're both curious about, you know, we're both curious and open about, you know, living in ways that it's important to both of us to live a life that is aligned with what is important to us. Mm-hmm. And we're both, you know, willing to go there, curious about going there. And I dash from problem to solution in like 30 seconds. Whereas my husband takes his time.
He meanders.
And one of our friends noticed us when one of our houses over the years, we lived near a creek, like a little stream. And one of our friends was an elderly man who had two good dogs. When I would see him across the stream and want to have a chat, I would clomp across the stream in my big boots with a coffee on either hand and say, you know, hello, Tony. And my husband would sort of test the stream, see how deep it was, see if there were any rocks to cross, and then usually go the long way around to say hello to Tony and pet the dogs. And Tony would say, this is just like the two of you. James, you know, is a lot more considered and he takes the long route, but he gets there with his boots dry. Whereas you clomp on through and you could have dropped both coffee mugs, but there you go. Mm-hmm. And so I had brought up the idea of let's move to the shed a few times as kind of a, hey, this is a crazy idea, but let's gather inspiration around it like you would with a writing project. You know, most ideas we have at the beginning sound like crazy ideas. Let's write a book set in the underworld with mothers and daughters. Like, wouldn't that be fun? Like, if we said no to all of our crazy ideas, we would never write anything. So as writers, I think we're pretty good at saying, like, let's put this out there, not destroy it before we've had time to let it live a little bit and see. But my husband, who's not a writer, was in those early days kind of panicked by such things. So when I put out the idea of moving to the shed early on, he said, you know, please, can we not talk about this again? Please, can we try one of these other solutions? And so we sort of did this game a few more times. And I was trying to kind of be sensitive and look for other more reasonable solutions for the overwhelm. But then there was one night that just felt like in the story, it would be the kind of, would it be the all is lost point or would it be the midpoint? It'll be one of those two points. Mm-hmm. But it was the point when the dog had eaten one of the children's toys and had diarrhea, like up and down, like thousands of square foot of carpet, you know, all up and down the stairs. And like, so like one of us was, you know, trying to like hide all the other toys. The other one was like trying to figure out what to do about the dog. Both of the children like hadn't had dinner because of the dog. And then, you know, then the children were, you know, hungry and tired. And then they had an explosive argument over an object like a Lego. Like it was just every single buzzer went off at once. You know, like some days it's the dog, some days it's the house, some days it's the, it was just one of those, all the alarms were going off. Mm. And we finally somehow, you know, were able to get up to bed by, you know, midnight. And that night I was, you know, my husband was finishing his work that he hadn't been able to do because of the, you know, the kids and the dog and the Legos. And it was midnight and I was in bed and I was thinking, I was just entertaining this sort of fantasy of about just sort of jumping on a lifeboat and just like gathering like my laptop, my purple backpack, my people, the dog, and just like sailing away together. And it was just this like comforting mom boat fantasy. It was ridiculous, but it was in that moment so simple and so clear. The shed looks like a boat, that like all we need are, you know, our work, you know, represented by, you know, the writer and the laptop, you know, a few clothes enough to get us through a week, and our people, the dog. And what about the rest of it? No one needs the rest of it. You know, let's give this a go. And so I showed up in my husband's office and said, here's what we do. And I was expecting pushback again, and it was the middle of the night. But for whatever reason, I think we were both kind of in that all is lost vulnerability of like, none of our easier solutions are working. Yeah. And so he listened for a moment and then immediately got on board and got out his notepad and started sketching ideas. And then when I got excited and started flinging more of my ideas out, he was already like many steps ahead of me because he had kind of, you know, moved there in his way. But thought through the details. In a way, it feels like I sort of dream the dreams and he builds them out of wood. And so he sort of, so once he finally thought this is a great idea, he had a plan for everything, you know, where the kids would sleep, how we would do laundry, all the things. And so by the morning we were decided that we would do it. We set September, this was in March, we set September as our move date. So we did, so that was it. We found a renter, we packed up, we did all the things. But there are lots of sort of false starts. And I think that's the case for so many things, right? Like often before starting on a writing project or any project, a podcast, you know, we'll think this would be fun. Wait, this would be fun. Wait. And then maybe after a year of thinking, why have I not done this? And the reason for this has not gone away. Then we take that first step and realize, oh, there's this lovely sort of flow that comes from taking that first step. But I think there's a lot, maybe we have to sort of, going back to this idea of the sort of the floor and the scaffolding, like there needs to be enough of that to get the project alive.
Yeah. Do you find, you mentioned earlier about people's reactions, and I sometimes feel that when we do big things or small things, but the bigger things, I used to be a deputy head teacher of a school locally. And when I decided I was going to stop doing that, which, you know, I guess in maybe older generations' eyes is a safe, secure job. Everybody understood, like, you were, you know, you had an important job in a school. And I decided I just didn't want to do it anymore and I wanted to be a writer. And I made that decision. But when I made that decision, everyone's reactions were different. So lots of people were, oh, are you sure? Or, oh, wow, I don't know, is that the right decision? Or you would have other people who were like, oh, exciting, you know, so you get these varied responses. And I wonder, I guess, when you come up against that, and even if you are deciding to write a book for the first time, right, it can be a decision that is not on a big scale like career or moving to a smaller house. It could be, I want to write a book. And you get these reactions from people, be like, oh, really? Or, oh, that's going to be hard. And I wonder, do you have any kind of words of wisdom around how to manage that? Because I think that can stop people from even trying.
This is so true and so wise. And I love what you describe of that array of responses, because I think that it, at the end of the day, I think it helps to remember that each person's response is A, autobiographical.
Right. Mm.
And B, because they presumably care about us enough to wish us well. So I think that helps to sort of think this is their hope or fear. Mm. And this is well meant, which doesn't mean that it's always easy to field it. And my guess is that there are some of the responses to your quitting teaching that maybe gave you pause. Like, mm-hmm. yeah, mm-hmm. that kind of make you wonder, am I on the right path? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When I think that those are so interesting. I love that question. And I think there are so many different sort of parts to any answer to it. But I think that this is sort of a sideways thought. Well, this is maybe too much of a sideways thought. Well, I'll go ahead and say it because it's a sideways thought that came to mind. One of the questions that I give to writers in my classes sort of brings, it's a writing prompt that brings the most potent writing out. It's often one I'll do like on the first or second day, is something I inherited that I won't pass on. And it's a prompt that brings out, I think, that cuts to the question of what are my values that I'm glad to have had come from the world around me, the place I grew up, my parents, my grandparents, my best friend, you know, what is the stuff that I've taken into me that still should be there as I go on? Mm. And it's like sort of a fairy tale wheat from chaff separation question. And I think that in a way, any question that helps us sort of shake that out in our own souls is a useful question, even if it comes at an inconvenient time when what we need is, you know, a moment of our confidence to move forward. Those questions that give us pause, I think, are pretty useful questions. So I think maybe seeing them as useful questions to make sure that we've thought through the pieces, even if we must, as you said earlier about, you know, bucking the convention of January, we must trust the gut. Mm-hmm. And it may be that, like getting feedback on a book, you know, not all of it is going to sort of land right, but I think we can always tell if there's something true mm-hmm. in the criticism mm-hmm. versus something just cruel.
Yes.
So I think that would be the probably wisest, just to sort of think through, you know, what of this, you know, going back to the critiques of, you know, moderation and bankruptcy and marriage, you know, there was nothing in the marriage that was just a comment that felt like, thanks, but not useful. The bankruptcy was one that I thought was an interesting comment, because so much of my fear in living the sort of big American life that we were living was that we were setting ourselves up for failure financially you know, and sort of spiritual bankruptcy, that if I'm taking on jobs that I don't care about to support this big life where I'm not writing my novel or seeing my kids, like that is a major. So the sort of bankruptcy felt like it hit home, but in sort of a more spiritual way, but also it affirmed that financially that felt absolutely like the freeing decision, you know, for us. So that one was a useful one that felt like kind of sort of further fuel. And in terms of the moderation, I think that one sort of tickled me, because it felt like, well, part of, you know, being a writer is living a creative and storied life. And that feels just like a painless long shot of, mm-hmm. you know, it will be interesting. Even if it doesn't last very long, it will be interesting. Who needs moderation? It will be interesting. So I think maybe if we can look at those criticisms in terms of those qualities, the sort of, they're autobiographical, they're coming from a place of care, and maybe they are kind of interesting obstacles thrown in our path that ask us to sort of consider if there's anything that we've inherited from those questions that we want to take back to our decision. I think those are maybe empathetic ways to use it. But also, I think it's interesting for us in terms of the, you know, in terms of our creative work, there's really not any, I think, well, let me make sure I'm saying this truly. I think that for those of us who make art, who want to make art, if something supports our art, you know, if someone supports our art, if time and solitude support our art, we don't need a lot of it. You know, we just need a consistent, trustworthy dose of it. And I think that often when we think we need a whole life overhaul, you know, it's because some part of us is kind of starving for to do that creative work. So I think that we can maybe, as writers, be wise to put, to sort of, to ask if this is feeding our writing, let's assume that it's good. Let's assume that it's good. And if, you know, we have the counter argument of, you know, but you're a good deputy headmistress, but money, but this, but that. At the end of the day, if a stable job is not feeding the writing, then it is not good.
Oh, you're right. You're so right about the alignment thing, because that's something, I, again, as I've been thinking in, throughout the early stages of my 40s, around the alignment piece. And I know we, you mentioned stoicism earlier, and I really have become interested in it, I would say, in the last probably 5 years. I'm a big Ryan Holiday fan, because I feel like he's really brought it to the modern reader in a very easy to understand way. But the one thing I often think about is that that concept of memento mori, which is thinking about death. And I talk about this to people, and it's a really tricky one, because people seem to think it's quite morbid when you first talk about it. But I actually really feel that it's a good thing to reflect on when I'm thinking about these big life decisions or things that I feel are true to me. And you mentioned values, and really contemplating what are my values, and appreciating, like you said, that people will reflect their own fear maybe on the decision that you're making, and they put themselves in the position that you're of what you're doing, and they therefore think, well, I could never do that. So, and I read somewhere once about people worrying that you are going to change too much for them to, you're not going to be the same person that they know and love. And therefore they're almost protecting themselves in a way against having to get to know this new you. And I really feel like all of the decisions I make now are based on kind of the gut, massively. The gut is so important, but also this whole idea of, I do not want to get to the end of my life and think, gosh, do you know what? I wish I had tried my hand at writing. I wish I had written that novel. I wish I had lived by the sea. All these things that are things I'm thinking about right now are so important. And okay, people won't understand them, and that's okay. But it's having the courage, isn't it, to do them anyway, because they feel right for you, for your immediate family. And it's a thing, isn't it, to try and make these decisions and almost start small, make small decisions that maybe you think feel a bit more aligned to what you're doing. And the more you practice, like anything, the more you're then able to apply that to the bigger decisions.
Yes, I love that. I love that you brought up memento mori. That does, it does feel like something that does seem morbid at first, but at the end of the day, like, that is a certainty. We're all going to die.
Yeah.
And it does not serve us to deny that. And by kind of befriending that fact, we make such different decisions. I mean, even just saying that aloud does not make me want to go shopping. You know, like, we don't need more stuff. Mm-hmm. But it does reaffirm my desire to, you know, call my best friend from college, you know, get up and work on my book, eat a healthy dinner. You know, these small things that kind of, you know, we have very limited time, but we don't want to regret our own place in our own life. And it's, I think it's a really wonderful, I know a lot of people who have found a way to use that tool, that sort of death awareness. I was listening recently to a wonderful podcast by some Harvard Divinity School students. And one of them says that he begins every day in the shower by saying, I might die today. And he said he found it very comforting, which again, like, his podcast host sort of laughed and it made her nervous. But he said that it helped him kind of align spiritually with, like, if this were, you know, if this is what I've got, how will I live? Mm-hmm. And that it was like a really helpful question. And I think that that a lot of the people I've learned to write with and spent time with and interviewed for some of my projects have been centenarians. And so I'm obsessed with sort of the wisdom of people who, you know, have lived to, you know, 100 or 90, who've lived a long time and who can really look back with that perspective on the sort of landscape of memory and what mattered. And then it takes questions like, you know, your earlier question of, you know, two things you brought up. It gives them such a wonderful, such a loving answer. Like the fact that there is a tilt toward the business and a tilt toward the book. Like, looking back from the, you know, the mountain of your 80s or 90s, like, you will have done both. And it won't have mattered which season was heavier on one or the other, as long as both of them are alive in your life. And the question of when the children are older, like a way, what is something that you and your husband would like to have done? You know, say it's live by the ocean. Mm. It may be doing a home swap for 3 months or 6 months with someone who lives by the ocean and see how it goes. And it may be that after that, you're like, well, that was our ocean. Yeah. Or it may be that you love it and move to the ocean. Or it may be that there's some sort of lovely halfway of, you know, we swap, you know what I mean? There's so many ways to supplement, you know, to supplement ocean. You know, every August we spend at the ocean, every whatever, you know, this half of the year, that half of the year, the writing half, the teaching half. So it just feels like whatever are the necessary components for us to live deliberate, creative lives, if we're alive to them and open to them, I think they can all fit, even if even if maybe not all today.
Mm. And also not always how we think they're going to fit, because that's the thing, isn't it? It's about having the trust and the courage to think. I had a wonderful conversation with a coach once, and it transformed how I viewed everything I did around setting goals and thinking about what I wanted my life to look like. And she just said, you just need to orient yourself in the right direction. But she said, you need to let go of the wheel and just see what comes in. And I'd spent most of the first part of my professional life, I think, setting goals, thinking, right, I'm going to achieve them by doing X, Y, and Z by these dates and these deadlines. And of course, deadlines are helpful. We're both writers. We know a deadline is always helpful. But I think it's about releasing our grip on exactly how things are going to turn out and thinking, okay, like you said, with the example of living by the sea, it's like, okay, I'd like to spend more time by the sea. And actually what that looks like, it may be that we live by the sea. It may be that we holiday there a few times a year, but actually it's just setting that intention, setting like my life to go on that kind of course, but not being so rigid in how I get there.
Yes, I think that's it. I think that we get ourselves into trouble when we go into things with rigid thinking.
Yeah.
And I think it brings up an interesting question for us as humans, and especially as writers, about what is enough. You know, what is enough to look back and say, I lived by the ocean. I have lived by the ocean. And I think even 1 year of that, I will pack in my heart and cherish, you know? And, you know, how many books, how much is a writing day? You know, for some, like, I think about how, you know, these days, a good half hour counts as, you know, having written, you know, if that's enough. And, you know, 4 hours is nice too, but a day is, I feel in touch with my inner writer if I even just do some small task for the book. So the enough is often so much smaller. And I think you and I talked earlier about having teenagers, and I'm now recalibrating, as I know you've had to do, what it means to sort of parent enough. And I'm having some growing pains about that right now, because I still think I'm forgetting that they don't, you know, I'm still thinking that the more quantity time they get with me, the better. But actually, they don't want that much quantity time with me anymore. But they want, you know, maybe, you know, one lovely 10 minutes before bed when I listen well and don't give them advice. And that, and I screw up on that all the time. But if I can remember that, like, that's enough for them right now.
Absolutely. Oh, I love that. I love that, the enough. Now, I'm going to do a little segue into, because you talked about writing, and even if it's just half an hour a day, and it would be absolutely remiss of me not to ask you about your writing practice and what your habits are. And I am always fascinated by everyone I speak to on the podcast. I always ask about, you know, what does writing typically look like in terms of a process for you, or a daily habit if you have it? I'd love it if you wouldn't mind just sharing a little bit about how do you approach, if you're sitting down, say, to start a new book, or you're in the throes of the first draft, for example, how do you approach it? What's the process?
Yes, I love this. And I would love if you're willing to ask you the same question after I've answered.
Of course.
So the constant for each of my books is that I feel a book needs a time, a place, and a treat. And that time, a place, and a treat. And so for my first novel, the draft was done at this beautiful borrowed office that my midwife friend let me use. She'd put it on the market to sell, so it was empty. And I had just started my tiny toddler daughter in a little Montessori school. I would drop her off at 7:30, and from 8 to noon, I had mother's milk. You know, I had my midwife friend's office to myself. And so the time was 8 to noon. the place was Mother's Milk. And I would always stop by the Boise Co-op on the way in and get some lovely treat of a drink that felt like I was happy to sit down at a desk and drink that thing. Mm-hmm. It was some chai latte, some gorgeous drink in hand. Yeah. Time, place, treat. My dissertation was Gregory Gymnasium because it had, good light between, when the bus dropped me off at 10, between when I needed to get ready to teach at 2. And this is gross. A Frappuccino, because there was a Starbucks downstairs. Time, place, treat. And in both of those cases, I was a younger writer, and 4 hours most days of the week seemed to be what got me in flow in such a way that I didn't resist the book when I sat down to write it, or I didn't lose touch with it, which then leads to that horrible thing happening when you open the book and you feel like, what are you? Yeah. I shouldn't be writing you. So 4 hours, 4 or 5 days a week, usually 5, felt like it kind of kept me in that stream for those. And now I find that 4 hours is, I still need a time and a place and a treat. And it does vary for each book. Some books I just feel like belong right after the sort of dream state ends before I've even, gone for a walk. Some of them belong before breakfast, and then some of them belong once I've gotten my kids to school. But generally speaking, for me, the earlier the better, and maybe 1 hour before I have a conversation with anybody counts as much as maybe 2 or 3 hours after a conversation. I think a lot of writers have felt that way. I remember reading a lot of books on writing routines, and they all seemed to write at dawn. And in my 20s, I thought, well, surely I can get out of that proposition. Like, that just sounds lousy. I'll be charmless after 9 p.m., but I just gave up and accepted that I'll be charmless after 9 p.m. because that morning time is so awesome. Mm-hmm. The morning clean brain is so good. Mm-hmm. So usually morning, but I now have this other thing that I've been doing for a while. Here, I'll show you and I'll read it for your listeners. I make myself a little list of 5 things that are important to me to do every day. And so it's just like a little, nothing fancy, but just on Microsoft Word, I sort of print out today, a book task, a work task, something I do for my body, some exercise, some yoga, something fun, which, writer's idea of fun sometimes is like, reading something that the rest of the world would call punishment reading, but something that I identify as fun. And then just give my people some love, like in the form that they can digest.
Yeah.
And today, what if I tapped off? I've checked off work task. I did my work task. But so something like this sort of, again, I don't need it every day, but when I feel like the book feels too big, it helps me to think of it as just a task. And I just need to move this next task forward. And the clearer I can be with myself on that, the easier time I have. And so sometimes I'll write at the end of a writing day, start here, and it'll be, start on page 35, describing the moment when the mother and the daughter get into this argument or whatever it happens to be. And so that breadcrumb trails help. But I wish that there were something that worked every time. And I've come to feel that each book has its own demands and logic, and that part of the creative process for the book is sort of like the way that a cat has to, circle before sitting, that we have to kind of create the nest in which the book will live, the time, place, treat. And then that gives the book the safety to come. What about you?
Well, I mean, I think I've developed a practice from necessity. So when I wrote my first book in 2015, I was still full-time deputy head. I had 2 young children at that point, and I was really, really keen to write the book. It was a book for teachers. And I tried all sorts of different ways. I thought, oh, I'll do it when I get back from work, which, stupid idea. I don't know why that ever thought came into my head. Anyway, and it had to be before the children got up. And it had to be before I left for work. So I made the decision I was going to write at 5 a.m. And I only had 30 minutes. I thought, I've got to do this in a way that when I get up at 5, because it's like James Clear says in Atomic Habits, make it easy, make it appealing, the laws of good habit formation. And it was, okay, I had to make it appealing. For me, half an hour felt, 5 a.m. was not appealing. So I thought, right. And it was winter. I remember I started it in the winter, which now looking back, who knows how I wrote it. But anyway,
I did.
Yeah. And I think it was get up at 5, write for half an hour, go to work. And that was kind of the way that I got the book written, because I thought, there, I'm so desperate to write it. There has to just be a way that I'm going to have to just suck it up and get up at 5 a.m. And I did it. And I wrote the next two in a similar way. I think by the time I got to the third one, I was part-time. So I was able to write not at 5 a.m., which was blissful. But I've carried on the 30-minute sprint thing. For me, that's worked. I've written all my books in 30-minute sprints every day. Sometimes I'll do two sprints. So I'll do half an hour. But like you, first thing, I'm very much a creative person in the morning. And then I might do another half an hour before lunch, but I cannot write in the afternoon.
No,
I cannot write at this time of day for sure.
No.
But like you, I have to have a coffee. It has to be a good coffee. And it has to be the same place again. I mean, I took so much from Atomic Habits when I read it around environment, making the environment work for you. And for me, it was sitting down at the same time, which is now 9 a.m. I write at 9 a.m. for half an hour at the same time, in the same place, with the same mug of coffee, literally the same mug every single day.
Time, place, treat.
Yes, exactly. So when you said that, I thought that is exactly me too. But I think it's interesting, isn't it, that when we do that, we almost take away the, when shall I write today? Do I feel like writing today? And what I realized is very early on, writing is work. And I have to view it as work. Otherwise, I won't do it. So as much as I love it, and I love it, and it never feels very much like work in terms of, you know, when you're sort of in the flow and it's all going swimmingly, when you're in that mode, it doesn't feel like work. So I know that half an hour seems good. Even if I don't feel like it, I'll write. I think, do you know what? I'm just going to write for a minute. I'll write for 2 minutes. I'm just going to finish this bit I started yesterday. Then I get back into it. So I trick my brain quite a lot with time. And I feel that it's a non-negotiable. If I'm a writer, I write. So that is how I make myself do it. I'm like, this is your job now. So sit your bum in the chair and yes. Do it. And yes. It does work. It does work. It's just very much a trial and error thing. And I've found now that this is what works for me. And I try and encourage all the authors I work with when I'm supporting authors, not to see it as, well, I have to write for 5 hours a day, because that's not appealing to many people. People who write professionally, that's not appealing. So if you don't have to take yourself off to a lovely cabin in the woods, you can, but it's not a necessity. So just the little things that you can bring into your routine, I think, mean that you'll sit down every day.
Yes, I love, I'm so happy you shared your routine. And I have a question, if you don't mind, about how you spend those 30 minutes, because my guess is that you have, that they're different when you're writing a book versus revising a book. How do you do the revision? Like, tell me what like a writing unit looks like in terms of what you kind of, tell me what those units, how they differ.
Yeah, well, I never read back my first draft ever. I learned the hard way when I first started writing, but that I was writing and editing at the same time, which was ridiculous because I was never making any progress. I think I must have revised that chapter one, and I never wrote any other chapters. So I made that discovery very quickly and decided that was not for me. So I now deliberately do not read anything back from the previous day. So I tend to do like you do. I leave little breadcrumbs. So I'll get to the end of, I'll literally have a timer. When the timer goes, I'll finish pretty much the sentence or the sort of section I'm on. And then I will leave myself some notes for the following day to think, this is what you were thinking at that time. When the timer went, this was your next train of thought. And then when I go back the next day, I just look at those little breadcrumb bits and just crack on. I just find that if I even start rereading the paragraph or two before, then I start tweaking so that's what it looks like when I'm in writing mode. And when I'm in editing mode, it tends to just be right. Today I'm focusing on this particular chapter or this particular section. And I'll work at it. And then if I feel like I'm overworking it, then I either stop or I think, right, okay, move on to the next bit. And I might leave myself a note, or I might, you know, that sort of thing in the manuscript, but I try not to really dwell on one part, because otherwise it just, there's no progress, right? And there's no momentum. And for me, I need that continuous momentum.
Yes. So this brings me to another question. And I love what you say about the 30 minute unit. And I just think that speaks so truly to the fact that we don't need 4 hours. We don't need 8 hours. That, you know, in my classes, sometimes the magic unit is 8 minutes. You know, we'll write for 8 minutes and people will get these beautiful pieces of writing that are what they needed, you know, what they would have considered a day's work, you know, whether that's by, you know, completing a scene or by word count. And it's just so little can give so much of its focused time. And I think that one of the things that can be very overwhelming, especially as our days change when our children get older and as we maybe become more efficient writers, is the sort of the rest of the day. And I put this aside from the fact that both you and I, you know, left jobs as teachers in order to put writing full and center. Mm-hmm. So I could sort of make the logical argument, like, if it just takes 30 minutes, and there is a need for that psychic space. And I'm now thinking about a quote by Henry David Thoreau, which is something about how, you know, a chicken doesn't lay eggs all day long. You know, it lays an egg and then spends the rest of the day kind of exploring and getting nourishment. But would you share a little bit about how you found your kind of rhythm with the rest of the time that supports those intense productive 30 minutes while also giving you, you know, a full life as a happy writer?
Great question. I think I underestimated the power of, and I know Anne Lamott talks about refilling your cup, and, you know, you can't, you to be creative. And often when we're faced with writer's block, she talks, doesn't she, about the fact that it's often that we're empty and we need to do that constant replenishment of our creativity cup. And so I will often, well, I walk the dog every day, so getting outside is imperative for me. But also I think I like to range the type of writing that I do. So I'll always be on a project. I'm currently working on my first draft of a book around writing, being a confident writer. So it's nonfiction, but I will always be dabbling in journaling. I'll always be reading because I feel like I learn so much about good writing from reading, and also about good structure as well when it comes to nonfiction. So I spend time allowing myself just to sit with it. And I've always got like an outline document. So it might be that I'm out for a walk and I'll think about something and I'll jot it down in my document to remind myself I want to include it. So I feel like we're always working on it, even subconsciously. But I feel like having that, like you said, that space to be creative in other ways and to explore things and to experience going to places and, you know, new people, meeting people, all of these things. There's always a gem of an idea for a character, and you'll meet somebody, you'll be like, oh yes, you know, so, yeah, you don't know, but you've just walked your way into my book, well done. Or, you know, so it's things like that, isn't it, that I think unless we allow that space. And I know, you know, I was mentioning before that I've not written a lot this year, and it was mainly because I had no creative energy and space, and without it is impossible for me to really feel like I can sit and just relax into it and enjoy it. It felt like I sat and I was just empty, just absolutely nothing. And now I've shifted things around and I've allowed that space, and now the writing is enjoyable again, and it's such a noticeable difference. So yeah, that's kind of how I like to replenish that cup. Do you have ways that you're able to do the same?
I love that. And I'm hearing you speak. I think that's why we're both March women, because March is like the beginning of the spacious month, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think I did the artist's way when I was in my 20s, and then I did it again this past summer, which was a joy, because the first time I did it, it felt very theoretical and speculative, and I was debating going to law school, and it felt like my marginalia was all of the sort of like, really? ? Could this be? Not sure about this. Sounds good. And then reading it again, I feel like, oh, you know, even though these principles are lost and found, and they're, you know, droughts, as she calls them, and, you know, stuck in flow periods of time when we write, all of those principles have become the sort of musculature of my creative life. Like, I read it with a sense of homecoming of like, oh yes. And I just finished the chapter 12, I guess, last weekend, and I'm sort of, you know, wanting to go do the whole thing again, but I'll wait till next summer. But in the very end, she talks about how if we're sort of living in a way that's open to just the beauty of the world and how it can feed our writer, that the whole, all of life can be an artist's date. She says something like that, meaning a time to go out and kind of fill our bucket and fill our well of images, as she calls it. And I feel like these days, as my kids are at these independent ages, and as I'm settling in, as I'm, you know, have been teaching for about half of my life in a way that doesn't take, you know, I teach adults and I have as much writing time as I need. And the teaching feels wonderful in that it's conversations like this. I get to talk to writers who are interesting and wise. And so I feel like the pieces of my life are all right now very energy giving. And I love that. And I'm feeling right now that most of the things that are just sort of ordinary life maintenance, like going to my classes and going for a walk, and when it's my dinner night, making a minestrone, all feel like ways that feel replenishing. You know, I think that I'm lucky that there are very few things right now that feel like sort of bucket dippers, as they say. You know, one of them is like a day doing admin. That's always really boring. Like taxes, you know, like when you've not checked email for a long time, you're like, oh, right, I'm late on this. You know, anything that involves like, I'm going to do it wrong or with guilt. You know, so every life has that. That's definitely the minority. Mm. And so I'd say most of the sort of 3D life of an ordinary day feels pretty replenishing.
Mm. Oh, fantastic. Now, I know we are coming to the end of the conversation, and I know you work with writers. So I ask this of every guest because I feel like everyone has a slightly different answer, which I feel listeners really love, which is, I would say the large majority of people that listen to the podcast are people who are either thinking about their first book or in the process of writing it. If you could give them a nugget, a single thing that you would say to an aspiring writer, because I know you work with them, what would be something that you would like them to take away with them?
Doing it is easier than thinking about it.
Lovely. I'd love you to just elaborate a tiny bit.
I think, you know, it's easier to just write for 30 minutes than it is to think all day about whether or not we should write or whether or not we wrote. And the same, I think, holds true for probably anything that we know we'll be happy to have done. You know, like for like 10 years, I read books on meditating. And then one day I thought, let's just give this 5 minutes. And it's lovely. It's not that scary. It's just 5 minutes of like peace. But, you know, there's nothing that replaces the 5 minutes of doing it. You know, I could have read books for another 10 years.
Yes.
But, you know, whether it's, you know, meditation or whether it's writing or whether it's, you know, anything, whatever the thing is that feels important and difficult is easier to just do, now, you know, today, even imperfectly, even just for 30 minutes or 5 minutes or 1 minute, than to spend another day thinking about why we haven't done it. That would be my wisdom.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And I really appreciate your time today. And I will link to your books and information about you if people want to get to know more about you in the show notes. But for now, this has been one of my favorite conversations, Elizabeth. And to be fair, that is hard because I have some amazing guests, but I really feel like this is in my top three. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. I've loved this time together. And I'm so happy to have spent this hour with you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for joining me and Elizabeth for this conversation about editing our lives to make space for creativity. I have to say, and I said it at the start, this has been probably one of my most favorite conversations out of all of the ones I've had so far on this podcast. So I really want to thank Elizabeth for such a thrilling insight into how she writes and how she lives her life. Really got me to reflect on my own practices and how I view the world. And I just loved every minute. I really loved the bit that she said around doing the thing is easier than thinking about it. And it's such a great reminder for all of us writers, but also just, I think, in life, when sometimes we get caught, don't we, in overthinking rather than simply putting the words on the page. So, yes, if you enjoyed this episode, please do forward it on to somebody else who you think would enjoy it. Share it with a writer friend of yours or business friend of yours or just anybody you think would really enjoy listening to that stuff around creativity. You can find the link to Elizabeth's books and her website in the show notes. But until next time, my lovely, lovely friend, happy writing.